or an ultraviolet spectrometer, or a bacterial growth experiment, or if you're familiar with ships and maritime shipping, there was one built in Norway to determine the position of AIS beacons on ships. Every ship in the world over 50 feet is supposed to have an AIS beacon. And for maybe $200,000, a university in Norway was able to build an entire satellite this size that was launched as a piggyback payload, as a secondary payload with a rocket that has a totally different purpose to carry some other satellite into orbit. But there's almost always a little extra room. And so the launch may cost $50 million for the primary payload, but may cost $50,000 for the secondary payload, or often is launched for free. And I don't know about the arrangements in France or with the European Space Agency, but in the United States, if an academic institution, a university, wishes, if they're building a CubeSat and they wish to have it launched, they can apply to NASA, and there's a competition that happens every year, and they write a proposal according to certain guidelines, and NASA, in collaboration with the Defense Department, that also has several launches every year, NASA will judge those entries and award 10 or even as many as 20 recently in a year a launch. And the cost of that launch is $30,000. But if you the cost for that launch for the one CubeSat is $30,000. But if you deliver the spacecraft when you are told that you need to deliver it to the launch site, the fee is waived. So it's zero. And this is something that NASA and the Defense Department are doing to encourage universities to build satellites this size. And so by the end of this year, almost 100 of these satellites will have been launched over the last 10 years. The first ones were launched in 2003. So all of those satellites have gone into low Earth orbit. So I've worked for 35 years at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is one of the NASA facilities in California. And as you may know, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL as we're widely known, we fly many interplanetary missions. We also fly Earth orbital missions, but the most recent well-known JPL mission, of course, is the Curiosity rover on Mars. So that's a very large, very expensive, very broad coverage of many science disciplines, many different instruments, high capability, able to drive many kilometers, designed to last at least one Martian year and may last longer than that. So that's at one end of the cost spectrum. At the other end of the cost spectrum are CubeSats like this. We have 7 CubeSat projects in progress today that are funded, that actually have money being used, that people are spending time, paid time. Almost all of them are done in collaboration with at least one other university. And one of them, the 7th of those to be initiated last December, is called INSPIRE. The acronym it's the first interplanetary CubeSat, or the first CubeSat beyond to go beyond Earth, we hope. Because we realize that there's, so I mentioned these, that there can be up to three of these units all together. They're not, they don't need to be separate. It can be 10 by 10 by 30 centimeters. And the Inspire project is to launch two of those together, which will have telecommunications equipment on board that is able to transmit and receive using NASA's Deep Space Network, and is able to be tracked in a way that will allow us to determine the position of those satellites to within a few kilometers initially, and to within maybe 100 meters after processing of that tracking data. So that's not as good accuracy as we do on the larger planetary missions. On those missions, we may know the distance to the satellite and its position to within a meter or so, even when it's at Mars. But a few hundred meters is good enough to do a wide variety of missions, where instead of having the many large instruments that are on the Curiosity rover, maybe we have one instrument, maybe one camera, maybe to look at the clouds in the Mars atmosphere, or to orbit the moon and make images over time of the polar regions that we can't see or can't see well from Earth. So it is the interplanetary CubeSats that I've been most involved with, and which we are looking forward to over the next 10 years on more than one of those per year being launched to different destinations. To Mars, to the Moon, to asteroids, maybe to observe the Sun from high solar latitudes. We have many concepts that we're discussing, but right now we're building the first one for test and demonstration of the ability to communicate and to navigate from deep space with something that is about the size of a box of cereal. So this is a lot of, it's a different way, it's a much more narrowly focused, because you can't put everything on. But if you can do something at all, that's so different than the situation was even as little as 5 years ago. So I encouraged Guy to talk with some people at your university, and my understanding is the CubeSat Reunion Island Station, or CRIS, is to be up and operating in a few weeks, capable of tracking some of the Earth orbit CubeSats with some of the universities, representatives of whom Guy has spoken with over the last week. Maybe Guy can tell you a little bit more about that.
No, I'll move, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So, did you get the message from Rob?
Yes.
Okay.
The message. I don't understand your question.
Bon. So you have at SALM, you have two cardboard models of CubeSat. Enfin, one cardboard and the...
I have one...
Yes.
Okay. So that's our 3D, that's our model for Demoiselle. And maybe we have, this one we didn't succeed, but maybe we have soon a Demoiselle 2.
Very good.
So, Demoiselle is designed to fly in low Earth orbit. And what is the topic for next Friday presentation is what Rob just said, and exploring the possibility to go far beyond the Earth, to the Moon, to Mars, to asteroids. And it is amazing to communicate with such a small thing, because the antenna is just a whip antenna or something like this.
Or sometimes up to this big.
Yeah. And maybe, okay, so Rob, what kind of receiving systems do we need on the Earth for an interplanetary CubeSat? Because I think we need a big station, do we?
In the near term, that is to say in the next 4 or 5 years, we expect to use some university-based large antennas on the order of 20 meters in diameter to do the tracking at X-band.
Okay, X-band is what frequency?
What is that? That's like 8 to 9 gigahertz,
I think? Yes, 8 gigahertz.
And there are several universities in the United States, and probably some also in Europe and Australia, with that capability. One of the best in the United States that I only recently learned of myself is at the home institution of one of the professors who invented CubeSats. It's a university you have probably never heard of, called Morehead State, M-O-R-E-H-E-A-D. And if you look up Morehead State University in Kentucky and go to their space tab, you'll be able to see a picture of their 20-meter dish antenna, which we may be using to track interplanetary CubeSats in addition to NASA's Deep Space Network. Because the NASA network is very heavily subscribed. Almost every hour is spoken for. So we can maybe get, you know, a half hour here and an hour there to track CubeSats. But antennas at universities typically have much more available time. And so we'll be working with those universities. So that's in the next 4 or 5 years, and that will continue on for some time in the future. But beyond that time, we're also looking at developing within, so I said there might be 6 of these units in one interplanetary CubeSat. Within all of the telecommunications equipment can fit in one of those 6 units, one like the size that I just held up. In fact, we're developing an X-band with UHF equipment to do that. This is what Guy is holding, is a toy inside a CubeSat that was the table decoration at the banquet for the workshop that we were at this past week. It's not part of real CubeSat hardware, but so in any case, so the radio frequency, the X-band and UHF equipment is being built right now to fit within one of those so-called 1U, the 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter cube, the same size. But we are also working on, over a somewhat longer time, the ability to put an optical communications terminal in the same volume. This would operate at a near-infrared frequency, I think a little under 1100 nanometers in wavelength, so not very far into the infrared. And it can communicate with a large optical telescope on the ground. So, for example, JPL is operated for NASA by the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, and Caltech also owns the 5-meter optical telescope at Palomar Mountain in Southern California. And so we can use that facility or any other large telescope as the receiving station on the ground. So it's 5 meters, which is still very large for a telescope, but it turns out there are becoming available a few of that size class optical telescopes around the world as people build even much larger telescopes in the Andes Mountains in Chile, for example. And so we're hopeful that a network of optical communications receivers can be set up. Because you can have a lot of power in the laser on the ground, you can get by with a smaller diameter telescope to send the commands up to the spacecraft. And for that, JPL has what's called, they have a 1-meter optical communications telescope laboratory also in Southern California, but not at the same place as Palomar Mountain. It turns out to be just maybe 60 kilometers from my house where we're talking to you from, called the Table Mountain Observatory. And so we can send commands up to these distant interplanetary CubeSats from the 1-meter telescope and receive the data at a 5-meter telescope at not a super high data rate, but out at Mars, we believe that during the nighttime, we'll be able to receive up to 2,000 or maybe a little more, 2,000 bits per second coming down. And during the daytime, when the sky is bright, we can still communicate, but at a lower data rate, maybe 400 or 500 bits per second. So that's, we expect that to take shape beginning 4 or 5 years from now, but when the InSpire CubeSat is completed next year, late in 2014, we expect to have all the RF equipment built for the satellite, as I said, to work at UHF and at X-band, and we'll be tracking it that way with the Deep Space Net, and with, there's a University of Michigan antenna at a place called Peach Mountain, north of the campus in Michigan, and so that's another university with the capability to receive data and send commands. Yes. Its destination, because it's simply to test the equipment, its destination, it's just a test and a demonstration. Its destination is just to go far beyond Earth, to actually escape Earth's gravity and go into orbit around the sun. And its mission, its primary objective, is to demonstrate the communications and navigation capability at 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. Now, we expect it to still be operable beyond that distance, maybe as far as 5 million kilometers, but we're designing for the 1.5 million kilometers. It will also have on board a very sensitive magnetometer to measure the Earth's magnetic field, and then as it leaves the Earth, to measure the much weaker solar magnetic field as it goes away from the Earth. And that will provide useful scientific measurements for however long we can communicate with it. But what's particularly useful about it, which isn't a primary objective but kind of falls out of the engineering objectives, is there will actually be two of these InSpire spacecraft, two of the so-called 3U configuration, and they will be launched together as secondary payloads. There will be some other primary payload on the launch vehicle, someone else paying for the ride. So NASA has agreed to provide it a free ride. They just haven't determined which ride that will be at this point. So two of those spacecraft will be launched, and they will not have their own propulsion. They will simply drift as they're pushed away from the Earth at the end of the launch vehicle's mission. And they will drift apart slowly so that after a few weeks they may be a few tens, maybe over 100 kilometers apart. And each one will have this very sensitive magnetometer on it, so that we've had many spacecraft up where it's a single spacecraft with one magnetometer, and we see variations in the magnetic field over time as the magnetometer is making its measurements. What we don't know is whether those variations are because of the time that the magnetic field has been influenced from the sun, or because the field strength is different here and there at the same time. You can't separate the spatial from the temporal difference. But if you have two of them together measuring at the same time, then we'll be able to determine that. And someday we hope to launch a cluster of maybe a dozen of these scattered in kind of a three-dimensional sphere to be making the same measurement from all the dozen or so interplanetary CubeSats in that sphere to make a very detailed, to allow a very detailed understanding of the difference between spatial variations in the magnetic field and temporal variations in the magnetic field. Because when you can look at many points at the same time, you can get data that it doesn't matter how good a magnetometer you have in one place, that's all it's going to tell you. And the cost of these satellites is single-digit $1 million. So a low-Earth orbit CubeSat that's quite capable maybe costs $1 million, an interplanetary CubeSat a few million, but if you build 10 identical interplanetary CubeSats, then the first one is a few million, and each one is maybe $1 million after that, if you build 10 of them. So you can do a whole investigation like the one I just described for maybe 20 million that you could not do heretofore, even with a spacecraft that cost 10 times that much. Yes. The university that has Peach Mountain that I mentioned is the University of Michigan. Michigan is a state in the north central United States. And so the Peach Mountain tracking station may be used for interplanetary CubeSats. It's not so much used for Earth orbiting CubeSats so far, although it may be later. They're commissioning the station, and the university only recently acquired it, where it had been used for radio astronomy investigations by another institution. Anyway, I'm sorry. You asked about Earth applications. So, some CubeSats most of them so far have been very simple. It's possible to get pretty high quality imagery from CubeSats. So that's one application, everything that you can do with imagery. One of the University of Michigan satellites, called RAX-2, or RAX-2, was used to measure a particular kind of propagation of electromagnetic waves in the ionosphere, where a missile tracking radar in Alaska was used to transmit up into the ionosphere at a frequency that's absorbed in the ionosphere, where the RAX satellite, higher up in the ionosphere than where the absorption was happening, was then measuring the propagation of that injected energy and investigating details of how that propagation occurs in a way to determine certain properties of the ionosphere which couldn't be determined before that. One of the JPL spacecraft that's being developed, JPL CubeSats, it's a mission called RACE, R-A-C-E, and it used to be called CHARM, C-H-A-R-M. The name changed, but the objective didn't. So it's testing a radiometer that operates at 183 gigahertz that is a water vapor absorption line in the atmosphere. And we're hopeful that if that test is successful, that first of all, that kind of radiometer in a small package at low cost will be qualified by the CubeSat. People have built radiometers at that frequency, and I believe some are flying today, but they're very large and very expensive. So if we're successful with that radiometer development, and then there's a similar development going on at MIT of 118 gigahertz radiometer, the combination of those two frequencies can allow a small satellite or a group of CubeSats to make very detailed measurements of what's going on inside hurricanes. How the water vapor comes up from the ocean surface, dependent on the temperature of the ocean and on the wave action and so on, and how it propagates up through the troposphere, where energy is absorbed, where energy is released, and help us understand the internal dynamics of hurricanes in a way that we think may improve the ability to forecast the intensity variation of hurricanes over time much better than we do today. Today, we're able to forecast the tracks of hurricanes reasonably accurately a few days forward, but we're unable to accurately forecast the variations in intensity, which of course have a lot to do with how much damage a particular hurricane will cause when it reaches landfall. So those are a few Earth applications that I'm aware of. There are many more. And if you're able to go to the website that Gee sent you for this CubeSat workshop and look at some of the presentations, you'll see many more ideas and concepts and some mission results that have been that are being pursued by a variety of different groups, many of them university groups. If you go to www.cubesat.org, you will find all of the presentations. ORG. I'm not sure I understand the question. Maybe if you ask Guy in French, part of it was the fidelity of the connection is not very good. But maybe you can ask Guy in French and he can ask me in English.
No, so okay. Optical reception is not within capabilities of Chris at this time. At this time, and for at least 2 or 3 years to come, Chris will receive within the UHF band, and as I understand, we will not be able to be useful for the interplanetary spacecraft. But the interplanetary spacecraft, you need only basically 3 points on the Earth to have a full-time reception. But CHRIS will be useful for low Earth orbit satellites.
And at this point, there are no interplanetary CubeSats yet. So the first won't be flying until at earliest the end of next year. And 5 years from now, we expect there will be several. And who knows what will happen on La Réunion in that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So to sum up, low Earth orbit CubeSat, we already had 70 going by the end of this year or next year to more than 100. And interplanetary CubeSat is something new that Rob and his team are developing starting next year. And this is of interest. Can you, Rob, tell a little bit more about the CubeSat you would send to Phobos, what it would do?
So Guy is referring to a very far out, difficult concept, one that could not be realized, I don't think, until the latter half of the next decade. But my team that I work with, We had a meeting as we were doing our formal development of this interplanetary CubeSat concept, and we were trying to think of difficult missions that we could use as examples. And as a joke, someone in our team meeting, they were by telephone with 6 or 8 of us online, and I don't remember, it was a meeting about a little more than a year ago. And we were having that discussion, and one of the people on our team, it might have even been me, I don't recall, said, well, of course you couldn't do a sample return with CubeSats. And we all laughed, because we all understood that that must be true. And then somebody said, well, why not? And we started going through each aspect of it and realized there was nothing fundamental about any part of the mission that would rule out the ability of a CubeSat, or we said, correct, one CubeSat cannot do it, but maybe 2 can. And so we came up with a mission concept where there are 2 interplanetary CubeSats, each with their own propulsion, each with a solar sail that's used for propulsion, which we hope to build into the next CubeSat after InSpire. But anyway, each with a solar sail for propulsion, and both of them leave Earth and go into orbit around Mars, and then rendezvous with Phobos, and one goes down to the surface. This cereal box size goes down to the surface, which is very easy to do at Phobos because the gravity is very, very low. Maybe less than one one-thousandth of the gravity on Earth. And so landing is more like a slow docking. It's much different than landing an airplane or Curiosity on Mars. And we realized that if that one CubeSat could get down to the surface, and we believe that it can contain all of the telecommunications, computer, imaging, navigation, all that equipment required, in addition to the solar sail that gets it there, it turns out that the escape velocity from Phobos, I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but the escape velocity from Earth is the speed with which if you throw an object at higher than that speed, it will never come back to Earth. And of course, all of our interplanetary spacecraft achieve escape velocity from Earth, and that's very difficult to do because the Earth's gravity is significant. The escape velocity from Phobos is 11 meters per second. A really good baseball player can throw a baseball at 11 meters per second. Maybe even a little faster. And then one of the people I work with did a calculation, and we said, maybe there's a better way, but if this CubeSat, when it lands, the surface of Phobos appears to be relatively soft, you know, some loose dust and sand and pebble-sized particles on the surface. So when the CubeSat lands, if it's just absorbed and grabs a little chunk of that, whatever it happens to land on, and so something wraps around the dust, the rock, and we have a spring behind that that fits in one U, like you saw, in a 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter cube. And in fact, the spring we actually designed, my friend Brian Trees designed such a spring out of a material that you can order. It might cost $1,000 to build the spring. And you compress that spring on the ground and have some way to release it, a burn wire or trip wire like we use on many spacecraft, so that once it's got the sample, then you trigger the release of the spring. You design the spring to launch the payload with 12 meters per second velocity. That means it's never coming back to Phobos. It goes into orbit around Mars, where the second CubeSat, with its solar sail, is waiting to catch it because you've launched it with a little beacon on it that has a light that blinks and a radio that broadcasts and says, here I am, come get me. And so the second spacecraft grapples the sample, perhaps after many orbits of Mars, and once it has the sample container, then it goes back to Earth, goes into a high orbit around the Earth, or maybe between the Earth and the Moon at one of the libration points, and we send up a spacecraft from Earth and go get the sample and bring it back to the ground. So it started as we were all sure that this was impossible. And then as we went through each of these steps and asked ourselves, is there any reason why we can't do this in a CubeSat? For each one, we came up with a plausible configuration or plausible approach that would allow us to do it with the kind of equipment that we think can be developed over the next 10 years following the path that the Earth orbiting CubeSats have done over the last 10 years. So maybe by 2026 or so, 2025, maybe we'll actually be able to do this. We don't know.
So to my mind, it's one decade, it's very long. If you think that is
We won't start on a Phobos sample return CubeSat until we think that the technology for all the different things is within our grasp. Between now and then, we will do many more that will help us go down the path that will probably make it achievable. So we don't have to wait for the period of time, whatever that turns out to be, to have a lot of fun and do some useful missions. Will it be 5 years or 15? I don't know.
Okay.
Money is always the limit.
Well. Voilà.
It's crazy, yes.
Yeah. So. Okay. That's okay. So, you know, it's a thought experiment. Une expérience imaginaire pour le moment, but that could easily become a reality after some time.
Yes.
So, Willie, I think that we will stop here, this meeting, and you will go through, try to go on the website of CubeSat.com
.org
sorry, www.cubesat.org, and I will send you a few slides. Maybe you can yourself recover some slides from this presentation on internet, and I think you have a basis for a good ordinary Café Martien. Okay? And I will be back, I think. I expect to be back next Saturday. And then, but in between, if you have more questions, send email. And it was a great pleasure to speak with you and see you and have a good breakfast. Did you have breakfast already?
No, not yet.
Not yet. So, yeah, so have a good breakfast and a good day.
Au revoir.
Allez. Au revoir. Yes. Yeah, because of the... Okay, going to close. Because of the configuration... Did you hear the echo with the 1 second delay?
Just I didn't.
Because yeah. When he was speaking, the microphone, of course, was picking it up,
yeah,
and sending
it back.
And we had it back, and it took about one second.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Almost like the moon.
Yeah.
Like talking with the moon.
Ah.
Okay.